influence and control. Practicality, practical use, and this is where I jumped off on this little eddy to the side. When I studied with my teacher, you may recall, I said I started with him and we did Buddhist practices without him telling me it was Buddhism because I was very young. But then I was enamored with Taoist practices and the Tao Te Ching, and then I became enamored with Native American shamanism, and then I became enamored with Buddhist Jewish Kabbalah, and went into all those directions. And he encouraged me, go into any direction you want, because from his point of view, one should find the direction which works, not because one is right and one is wrong. And that underlines the importance of practical application of a philosophical approach. For me, it's settled on Buddha Dharma, but for others, it can be other things. But there are certain tests, I think, that one can make to see if what one is doing is really helping, is truly helping, and is related to truth and to resolution and to harmony. And that is an improved life in the genuine sense, not in the temporary sense, not in the I feel good now, but rather I really feel good overall. And so it's not about that momentary ecstasy that experiences can bring, all kinds of experiences, but it's more about having an underlying contentment and happiness, or eliminating dukkha, as we call it in Buddha Dharma. So in terms of practical terms, some of the tools we discussed, and I know I'm repeating myself over many of the past discourses, but just in review, we're breathing, we're sitting quietly, we're asking ourselves, or is asking ourselves, what is really happening here? Or asking ourselves, is this in or out of our sphere of influence? And this is an interesting question. I just want to dwell here for a moment, because I have a very dear friend who found a companion that he cared for very much and had a very different worldview than he did. And yet he was convinced that he could discuss and spend time and persuade her, it was a her in this case, of a different point of view so they could be happy together. And so he spent a good year of his life trying to do this. And of course, it didn't work because she has her point of view. Regardless of whether it's correct or incorrect or accurate or inaccurate, it's her point of view. And he kept trying to share and educate her on a more open-minded point of view from his point of view. And she wasn't having any of it. And even to this day, he recently spent some time with some other friends and had such a wonderful time. And his comment was, yes, he has to let go of that other person. They're so closed-minded. They don't open up. They don't hear. They don't understand. And yet what we really have here is just a person trying to work outside his sphere of influence. Does everybody understand that?
Yeah.
The sphere of influence is you're out there, and even though you're attending this discourse, there's no way, and it would be foolish of me to ever think that I can persuade you or convince you to do anything, which is why I never want to present anything that I say as having that intention. It's more about exposing you to ways of thinking. It's about more about exposing you to different points of view. It's about more about giving you tools to contribute to your mental processes so that you yourselves can find your points of view. I read an article just now, a very interesting article by a doctor of Chinese medicine who has a very, very fancy website. He's referencing an issue that reminded me of my discussion with the management company here, is that when we get into a situation where someone is what we feel in a position of not correct, we try to find and stand our ground as being correct. Well, that really is a little tug of war of power, isn't it? It's about one of us insisting and the other, or both of us insisting that their position is correct, and therefore not being able to come to any kind of agreement. And that actually doesn't help anybody. Now, granted, if one's coming from a open-minded, philosophical, Buddha Dharma point of view, we are more likely to compromise, and the other person is likely to gloat over their victory. But it reminds me very much of a story of an old Aikido master and a drunk Japanese man and a late evening. Did I mention this story before on this discourse? I don't think so.
No, not that I remember.
Right. So I'm going to share the story. There was an American who went to Japan and he studied Aikido and he got really, really, really good. And he was riding the Yamanote line, which is the train that goes around Tokyo. And I think it goes almost 24/7. And it's very, very late at night. And late at night in Tokyo, a lot of drunks. They're not itinerants. They're actually working people that are inebriated after work. And they got onto the Yamanote line and they would just fall asleep or they would ride it or something like that on their way home. So one day this American Aikido student who's very, very good is sitting on a train. And the end of the train door opens and in comes this really big hulking Japanese guy who's very, very drunk and threatening everybody, going into their face and pulling them right up to him and saying, "Do you believe this? If you don't, I'm gonna kill you," and just walking on. And this American is thinking, "Well, now I'm gonna have a chance to really practice my Aikido. You know, Aikido is the martial arts of nonviolence. I'm gonna take him down and he's gonna protect all these people on the train." So he's saying, as soon as he gets here and starts to really be, if he becomes really rough, I'll jump up. Otherwise, if he gets here, I'll make sure that he doesn't hurt anybody. I'll protect everybody. So this drunk Japanese man gets to the center of the train and there's an old man sitting there. And so the guy goes up and looks at him and pulls him up and says, "Old man, what about you?" You know, and now this American thinks, "Well, this is going to be my chance." He's starting to get ready to spring to action. "And what about you? You know, I'm going to bash your head in," the Japanese guy is saying to the old man. And the old man looks at him and says, "Oh, you must be very unhappy. Come have a seat." "No, don't talk to me like that, old man. Who do you think you're? "No, come have a seat. Sit down for a moment." "No, come. And the old man pulls him and sits him down and says, tell me, what's the problem?" And within minutes, the big, rough Japanese drunkard is crying with his head in the old man's lap and telling him about his life and how his wife left him and he has no job and he's suffering. And within 5 minutes, the man was quiet and just sitting next to the old man with tears streaming down his eyes. And the American Aikido practitioner felt very, very, very stupid. Here he was thinking he's going to use the art of nonviolence to suppress this violence and make sure he protects the world, when in effect, all the man needed was a sympathetic ear and some compassion and some love. And the old man brought this violent giant to sit next to him and to calm him down. And so that story always sticks with me because it really reminds us that our point of view is really just our point of view and our perspective. And if you're reading our daily sends, the last couple of sends, and they deal exactly with that issue of perspective, that it's our perspective, beliefs, and opinions that gives the world the color and the flavor, our world, the color and the flavor that it has. And our perspectives and our opinions and our beliefs are formed a lot by our words. Now, words, which are the topic of today's discussion, are not just words on a sheet, printed or visual that we see, but words are also thoughts in our head. Everybody understand? Mm-hmm. Before we can even understand it's a word, it's a thought in our head. And before it even becomes a thought in our head, it's an entire assumption of values. Now, before we get into the actual process of looking at the words that were on the list, I'd like you to think about for a moment what that really means. That means we invest ourselves in a belief system that forms a perspective that creates a foundation from which we act and react to the world around us. And this has to start somewhere. And usually it starts, I would say, we could actually physically track it or genuinely track it from the point of in utero development, when the fetus inside the womb of the mother can begin to hear the sounds around it. Because that's the first perception from the sense sense. But we don't know yet. There may be even earlier perceptions or other perceptions through the chemical transmitters that are coming through in the nourishment of the fetus, right? In the placenta and the blood and the chemicals of the mother. So those are other perceptions. There was a woman, a very interesting woman, called Candace Pert, Molecules of Emotion by Candace Pert. It's a groundbreaking book. Candace Pert was a very interesting woman. She was on the team that discovered endorphins and function of endorphins in the body and the opioid receptors. And she was a very strong-minded woman. And when the leader of the team, I don't remember, it was the National Institute of Health. The story is now, I haven't retained all the details, but National Institute of Health, which is a big thing in the US, as you probably know, or was it in Georgetown University or one of the big universities, they were up for the Nobel Prize for the discovery. And they were going to give it to the leader. And she was really upset. She said, well, he just supervised a study. He didn't create the study. We created the study. And so what happened is she created a bit of a ruckus. And in the end, the Nobel, you know, said, we don't want to get involved in any controversy, so we're going to look somewhere else. And she was blacklisted for claiming what, just for claiming for the truth to be known to everybody of who did the research and where it was accomplished. But aside from that, she also wrote this book, Molecules of Emotion, which revealed a very interesting phenomenon. It revealed a situation that when we are in situation A and we feel something, say we feel love or we feel anger or we feel fear, the neurochemicals in our body and the hormones are in a certain matrix. Now, what does that mean? Are you familiar with the concept of fight or flight? That's a concept where adrenaline is stimulated, like we feel threatened, and then we get into a very basic pre-human, we call it limbic, from the limbic brain, a reptilian brain response. We have to either fight or we have to run away very quickly. And that changes our whole body physiologically. Like, for example, we're on the savannah in Africa and suddenly a lion decides to make us lunch. Well, we have to decide, are we going to fight the lion or are we going to run away from the lion? And if we start to run, or if we start to fight for that matter, something happens very interesting in our body. The blood is completely brought in from the limbs. So in case we lose a limb, we still have enough blood for our internal organs. At the same time, blood is flushed to the muscles, so we have more power. And at the same time, blood is taken away and function is taken away from our digestion so that we don't waste energy on digesting. We have more energy for thought and for action. Now, there are many more little processes that take place, but these are all stimulated by chemicals that flow through our blood, right? We call them neurotransmitters or enzymes or different molecules, or hormonal molecules. So all these molecules are in a certain configuration. Do you all follow me on that? Adrenaline is up into our heart, and we have epinephrine to our muscles, and we have calcium ion pumping away. It's lactic acid is cleared. Our kidneys are functioning to clear the blood. In any case, what she found is that if we recreated that molecular matrix, we'll call that a molecular matrix, okay, the position of where all those molecules are in our body 20 years later, we will experience the exact same emotion that we experienced 20 years earlier when the molecules were in that position. Which is not such a out there thought, right? Because it's all connected. But what she recognized and she showed people was that you could replicate a condition of the molecules to generate an emotion. Just as the emotion originally generated the matrix of the molecules. Which is in fact, exactly what traditional Chinese medicine teaches. It's a balance. It's a mirror image of each other, the physical and the non-physical. The non-physical, or what conventional science calls the non-physical, is just the things we can't see or measure with the tools that we have right now. But they're still there. So there's no real separation between physical and non-physical. It's just all is what is. And what Candice Pert demonstrated is when we look at just emotions and molecules, then we see we can create a reflexive experience. Is that clear? Okay. So what does that have to do with us and our topic today? Words. What that has to do with us and our topic today is that when we first learn what the first word means, and the first word in our list is I, all of our neurotransmitters and our chemicals are in a certain position, and we create a certain emotion. So the first time we learn about an I, the concept and how to express it, is the first time we learn about truly how to assert our identity. Agreed? Because I, or me, or a name, perhaps a name, baby, you know, mama, mama, papa, papa, baby, baby, name, whatever that is. The first time that word is formed, we have now established a pattern of assertion. And assertion is, I'm here, right? Isn't it? I like coffee. I don't like coffee. I like tea, not coffee. I'm a vegetarian. No, I'm a carnivore. You know, I'm a Buddhist. No, I'm a Jew. No, I'm a Muslim. No, I'm a Christian. Oh, I'm an atheist. And all of you are full of it. I. The minute that concept, we have that emotion, the molecules go into position of assertion. Understood?
Yeah.
I'm just looking at the words from one perspective. We're going to come back to the word from a different perspective in a little bit. We'll see if we have time, because this is going to be a very interesting discussion. I hope you find this interesting. This to me is fascinating stuff. The next word is you. The minute there's you, it's not an assertion, but it's a separation, isn't it? When I look at Senem, do I really see Senem, or do I see Oren's image of Senem? What do you think? Question.
You see Oren's image of Senem.
Of course. And when I hear Senem, do I hear Senem, or do I hear Oren's image of Senem, Oren's sound of Senem? Right? And when I look at Senem and hear her and see her, and then Oren's thought of, oh, dark hair, dark skin, or this kind of structure, or all the things of attractive, not attractive, like Senem, friend, all those things, right? That's all happening in all of us all the time. And then I apply the word you, or not the word you, but I can call it a name, or I can call it something out there. And suddenly there's separation. When in fact, what I see and what I hear and what I think about, what I impress on upon my mind, it's all me, isn't it? And so just to throw in a little nugget here, this is the fundamental foundation of the Buddha Dharma, is we're all one. Of why we have compassion, because what we experience is really all us. It's also a fundamental foundation behind, many religions, not just, I was going to use the term Hinduism because I'm familiar with a lot of expression in Vedanta, but actually all religions, that you treat others as you want them to treat yourself, because actually you are treating yourself, aren't you? When you relate to others, you're actually relating to your image of what you're perceiving. You're not really relating to them. And so if a person hurts another person, who are they really hurting?
Themselves.
Themselves, exactly. Because I perceive something out there that I decide is either a threat or I don't like or whatever the thought is, and I strike out or I protect or I do whatever, and that is actually attacking my own perception. By attacking my own perception, what happens? Do I remove the irritating perception? What do you think?
No, actually you you reinforce it, you enhance it.
Exactly. Why does that happen, Johnny? Well, well said. Why does that happen?
Because you confirm your perception by acting on it.
Okay. That's one reason, definitely. And what's the result of what happens when you confirm your perception? What happens in the mind when we confirm a perception?
You believe in it even more, you cling to it.
Exactly. Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. And it becomes a habit pattern in our head, right?
Yeah.
So there's an habitual, I don't like red puffy woolly sweaters. I see someone walking wearing a red puffy woolly sweater and, oh, that's horrible looking. Boom. Next time oh, that's horrible looking. A few more times and that's it. As soon as red comes into my vision, it's like, is that a red puffy woolly sweater? Oh, no, no, that's just a red tights. Oh, I don't mind red tights, but I don't like red puffy woolly sweaters. But the red already triggers the habit pattern. Mm-hmm. And that's the result. So all of this has to do with how we frame our perceptions and our experiences. And all of this also has to do with the issue of words and how words are formed in our mind.